Candidate Donald Trump said in the campaign trail that he would crack down on unauthorized immigrants in the United States. Now that he sits in the Oval Office, President Trump is making good on his pledge. The White House has said it intends to recruit local police officers to help with deportation, hire thousands of new immigration and customs agents, and open new detention facilities. What has gained the most attention, though, is that the White House has broadened the criteria used to decide who should be deported. President Trump has said that criminals are being rounded up at a rate that nobody has seen before, and he has described the deportations as a military operation. John Kelly, the Secretary for Homeland Security, however, struck a slightly different note at a press conference held during his recent visit to Mexico City.
There will be no, repeat, no mass deportations. Everything we do in DHS will be done legally and according to human rights in the legal justice system of the United States. All deportations will be according to our legal justice system.
I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations.
And I'm Robert McMahon, Managing Editor of CFR.org.
You're listening to The President's Inbox, a CFR podcast that examines the foreign policy challenges facing President Donald Trump. We look at the issues topping his foreign policy inbox and discuss what he has said he will do and what constraints he might face. This week, we're talking about the Trump administration's immigration enforcement policies.
With us this week to help examine immigration policy is Edward Alden. He's a senior fellow specializing in U.S. economic competitiveness and immigration issues here at the Council on Foreign Relations. Ted also directs CFR's Renewing America publication series, and he's also the author of Failure to Adjust, How Americans Got Left Behind in the Global Economy, as well as a previous book, The Closing of the American Border, Terrorism, Immigration, and Security Since 9/11. Ted, thanks for being here again.
Good to be here with you, Bob and Jim.
Ted, I want to start out with a broader look at U.S. immigration policy. And can you give us a sense of how the U.S. historically has dealt with illegal immigration?
Sporadically, inconsistently. So, I mean, if you look back, going all the way back to the Reagan administration, the United States has always been ambivalent about the presence of illegal immigrants, most of them coming across from Mexico, because for better or worse, they've been an integral part of our labor force, particularly in the agriculture sector, but over time in construction and landscaping and other sectors. So U.S. law is pretty clear. You're not supposed to be here without the legal permission of the U.S. government. But over time, we've seen the population of people here out of status grow from, you know, a couple of million back in the early 1980s to over 11 million today. The United States has never had a policy of aggressively trying to identify those people and remove them from the country.
At least not since the Reagan years. I mean, if you go back to the 1950s.
Well, you know, even going back to the 1950s, the infamous Operation Wetback under President Eisenhower, that was a one-time campaign to remove people, send them back to Mexico. And then a lot of them were brought back legally under what was known as the Bracero program. We have no contemporary equivalent to the Bracero program. So even going back to the 1950s, there has not been a consistent policy of saying, look, we're going to go look for everybody who's here illegally and get rid of them.
Why the ambivalence, Ted? I mean, we've had over that time span Democratic administrations, Republican administrations, but you're telling me there hasn't been zealous enforcement of immigration law.
I think part of it is that it's hard. So it's very difficult to find people, to arrest them, to deport them. It's expensive. I think a second reason is just as a country, we've been ambivalent about their presence. We know that the undocumented labor force has been a big part of the U.S. economy for a long time. The United States and Mexico, in various ways, are sort of part of a large labor market. Right? You have lower-skilled folks in Mexico, generally higher-skilled folks in the United States. There's a kind of natural labor market there. I mean, for years, we had no enforcement at the border. And Mexican men primarily would come over and they'd work in U.S. farms for half the year and then they'd go back. In modern times, we've tried to interrupt that. We've tried to really begin to secure that border. But we've never as a country gone to the point of saying, look, we are going to stop all illegal immigration and the folks who are here, we're going to find them, we're going to get rid of them. We've just never been able to move to that position.
Right. So Mexico has been a source of supply, but American employers have been a source of demand, and they have generally not been enthusiastic about scaling back a big part of their workforce because they need the labor.
Absolutely. No, they've been resistant to it. So there have been efforts over time to try to force employers to document the legality of their workforce. They've resisted in various ways. And again, particularly in certain sectors, you know, agriculture, you look at you know, the strawberries that are grown in California. That just wouldn't happen without a large labor force coming from Mexico, and the legal system doesn't allow for enough people to come in. So there's a strong economic rationale for not actually being too tough on illegal migration. Or
I would
at least
imagine,
there has been.
I would imagine, Ted, there's also a human element that these are people who have integrated in a number of societies, and you go to a state like California, and it's clear they're part of the cultural landscape, and there are people who would defend them. We can get into this a little bit later in the podcast, but it seems like that's also playing a little bit at play here.
No question. And over time, it gets harder and harder, right? You know, if you're deporting someone, you know, as a single young man who's been here for a year, nobody's going to make a big deal out of it. But if you've got people come, they get married, they have U.S.-born children who are American citizens, they've been here 10, 15, 20, 25 years, they're part of their communities, then this is a whole different situation when you're talking about removing people with those kind of deep roots in this country. So that's absolutely true, Bob.
So let's talk about where we are today. Now, I think it's safe to say that candidate Trump, now President Trump, made immigration policy near at the top of his list of things to do. We've already had in the early weeks of the administration this temporary travel ban. That has been caught up in the courts and is now on hold. What we're talking about recently is something different. We're talking about the enforcement or roundup of people who are not here legally. What exactly has the Trump administration done differently, Ted?
Well, the administration has moved and quite quickly on this issue, really more quickly than any other of candidate Trump's promises, to change quite dramatically the rules of engagement for Department of Homeland Security officials who are responsible for identifying and removing people. Under the Obama administration, and to be clear, President Obama took a lot of criticism from immigration advocates for the high level of deportations, particularly in his early years when he was trying to win Republican support for comprehensive immigration reform.
At some points, President Trump or then candidate Trump noted that to justify what he wanted.
Absolutely, yeah. And you know, the annual removal numbers exceeded 400,000 for the first sort of term of the Obama administration. So these were big numbers. But more recently, particularly after the Congress failed to pass comprehensive immigration reform, which would have included something that President Obama wanted, a legalization of most of the 11 million people here out of status. After that fell off the table, his administration really backed off and said, look, we are going to focus only on people who pose a threat to the United States. So people with serious criminal records, people who commit multiple misdemeanors, people who we think are a national security threat. If you are, you know, that family who's been here for 15 years, you've got American-born kids, you are not a priority. We are not going to go after you. You don't have to worry
about
that.
That was the Obama administration.
That was the Obama administration. The Trump administration now, with the president's executive orders and a series of memos from the Department of Homeland Security, has basically turned this on its head and said, look, illegal means illegal. And if we find you in the country and you don't have status, you face the very real threat of being removed. Doesn't matter whether you have American kids, doesn't matter whether you've been working in the country for 25 years, doesn't matter whether you're the Little League coach. If you are here out of status, you are now in genuine threat of being identified by the government and removed from the country.
But is the Trump administration, or more correctly, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement body actually systematically going out trying to find people, or are they concentrating particularly on people with criminal records? Because President Trump, in talking about it, has emphasized that under his tutelage, criminals, bad dudes, I think is the phrase that he uses, are the ones who are being deported.
We are going to see how this plays out. So I think out of the box, the first priority will continue to be criminals. The memos call for reviving programs that were shut down under the Obama administration to involve local police and law enforcement much more in saying, you know, if we've arrested someone for crime or on suspicion of a crime, turning those people over to ICE agents for deportation. A lot of that got scaled back under the Obama administration. This is going to be ramped up again. I mean, the most famous example was Sheriff Joe Arpaio in Arizona, who basically, you know, tried to deputize his police force to identify people here illegally. This is something the Trump administration is going to favor. So that will tend to catch people who've done something that's run afoul of the law. But the problem is criminal is a very, very broad term. I mean, we can be talking about murderers and rapists. We can also be talking about someone who committed identity fraud, I put that in quotation marks, by using a phony Social Security number in order to gain employment. That is something that under the new criteria is going to qualify very clearly as a criminal act.
We already see cases of that where people who were going in for normal routine interviews with ICE agents and they'd done it in the past and then been sent in their way is now told you committed identity fraud, you're being deported immediately. It was one case I know of, I think it was in either Arizona or New Mexico, where the mother was deported, leaving behind her American husband and her American-born children.
Yeah, we're going to see more and more cases like that. And at the moment, it's anecdotal, but we're seeing ICE agents end up in places we haven't seen them before, in the courtrooms waiting for people to come out after hearings. We had a case yesterday, Customs and Border Protection officials asking for identities from everybody getting off a domestic flight that landed at JFK because they had heard that there was somebody on that flight who was out of status. That is new.
Explain that to me, because I think most Americans would be surprised if you're on your flight from Iowa City to Chicago or Nashville to New York and you get off and all of a sudden there's a customs agent, border patrol agent there saying, show me identification. I think most Americans would recoil at that. And certainly for most Americans, if you'd ask them, prove your nationality, they wouldn't be able to. Americans don't carry national cards or passports as a normal matter of course.
Yeah, and we're very different from a lot of European nations in that regard where they have national identity cards. I think we're going to see a lot of this end up in the courts, but the powers of immigration authorities are pretty broad, particularly, and again, we'll see how this plays out, but particularly in the coastal cities, because technically under the definition of U.S. law, the border extends 100 miles inland. And that's 100 miles inland from the Canadian and Mexican borders, but also 100 miles inland from the coast. And within that zone, border authorities have
LaGuardia is right.
LaGuardia is right there, right?
Right on Island Sound,
Within that zone, and again, I think some of this is going to get tested out in the courts, but border authorities have more capability to ask people to prove that they are in the country lawfully. And I think we're going to see more and more of these kinds of cases.
Ted, you have a blog post this week on these memos and on the orders talking about some of the practicalities and some of the obstacles that are facing this. First of all, there's a plan for major ramp up in hirings of agents, but also the fact that there are courts are going to have to prosecute these things, that there's going to have to be the willingness of Congress to pay for it, the cities to go along with it. And we've heard a lot about the phrase sanctuary cities. Can you talk a little bit about what actually has to happen on the ground to make this work in the scale that I think the Trump administration wants it to?
Yeah, so there are going to be a series of obstacles. Let's start with hiring. So the DHS is talking about adding 10,000 ICE agents, which is basically a doubling of the Immigration Customs Enforcement staff. Talking about adding another 5,000 Border Patrol agents. That's up from about 20,000 currently. Well, if you look at current staffing levels, DHS has not been able to meet the congressional targets. I mean, Congress wants us to have 21,000 Border Patrol agents. The government is now about 1,000 short of that. They simply can't hire them fast enough. They're losing about 5% of their workforce every year. Attrition rates in DHS are extremely high. It's the agency with the lowest morale of any agency in the U.S. government. They're losing people. They can't find, recruit, and train them rapidly enough. So reaching numbers like that is going to be really hard. Problem number one. Problem number two is Congress got to pay for it. We're already talking about $20-25 billion for the wall that President Trump wants. You add that kind
of
personnel.
President Trump said he's going to drive the cost of that wall down in the short term. So he's going to get the Mexican government to pay for it in the long term.
Maybe gets it for $18 billion. Who knows? But it's going to be a lot of money that initially Congress is going to have to appropriate. To adding that personnel, you're probably talking about another $10 billion annually. So there's money there. There's a question of whether fiscally conservative Republicans are willing to put that kind of money behind this initiative. So that's a big limitation. You mentioned the courts. So the normal procedure, if you are arrested in the interior of the United States and charged with being here illegally, you have a right to go to immigration court. This is part of the Department of Justice. We have immigration judges who
They're
work for the Justice
from
Department.
Other
separate
courts.
From normal, you know, federal and state courts. There is a huge shortage of immigration judges in this country. The current backlog for a routine unlawful presence hearing is 2 years or more. So people wait 2 years for their day in court. The administration says, well, we're going to try to ramp that up. But again, that's hard. You can't kind of pull immigration judges out of a hat. There has to be training. There has to be a recruitment.
Because immigration law is quite complicated. You need to learn the rules. Not a lot of lawyers go into immigration law. There are actual reasons why we don't have a big pool to pick from.
Absolutely. And so that's going to be very difficult to ramp up. Now, the administration is trying to find ways around this. And this is going to be some of the more controversial elements of what they've done. There is a procedure in U.S. law known as expedited removal, which has basically been used in the border region. So if you're in the country, you've been here less than 2 weeks, you're found by a border patrol agent, they can say, you're here illegally, boom, we're sending you back to Mexico or wherever else you're from, called expedited removal. That's used quite widely in the border region.
Question on that. You have that expedited removal. You put somebody on a plane, or maybe, I don't know, you drive them in a
depends
truck
on where
across
they are.
The border.
Yeah.
Does Mexico have to take those people?
No, but Mexico does. Most countries do, though some countries resist. I mean, China resists in part. There are other countries that resist. That's a whole different set of issues that really get tied up with diplomatic relations between the United States and these countries. You know, but yeah, in theory, countries can say no.
Because, I mean, many people who would be deported back to Mexico might not be Mexican citizens themselves. They may have come into the country through Mexico, particularly Central Americans. So it's not clear to me, and I think the Mexican government has said it has no intention of accepting those people.
Okay, so we're talking two issues here, Jim. Okay. So let's try to clarify them. So to finish on the expedited removal piece. So normally, as I said, this is used in the vicinity of the border. Administration is saying now that it's going to extend that to anywhere in the country. And if they find somebody who is here illegally who can't prove that they've been in the United States for at least 2 years, which is not easy to prove if you're here without papers, can't prove that they've been here legally, or sorry, that they have been here physically for 2 years, then they could face expedited removal. That allows you to do an end run around the court system. They have no right then to a hearing before the immigration courts. Again, this is something else that's going to be challenged. I guarantee you the ACLU and others are working
on
this.
What if you have a disagreement with DHS over whether or not you have papers that show you've been here for 2 years?
It's up to DHS's discretion. You have to show to their satisfaction that you've been here for 2 years. Now, that out of the 11 million, the best estimates are that maybe 15% or fewer have been here for 2 years and less. So theoretically, that's not a huge number, but that's one way of getting around the court backlog. Jim, you raised a different question, and this was a big issue on the visit this week that Secretary of State Tillerson and Secretary of Homeland Security Kelly did to Mexico. Another element of these memos, the U.S. government is saying, okay, if we have somebody from Central America who comes up to the United States and we find them not eligible, but they have a right to a hearing before removal. And to be clear, about half of the people arriving at the border now are from Central America, Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador primarily. The U.S. government is proposing sending those people to Mexico, and they will wait in Mexico for the outcome of their case in the United States. The Mexican government is saying, no way. That is not our responsibility. We're not going to be a holding tank for Central Americans while you work your way through your legal process. So that came up in the visit this week. Mexico is clearly going to push back very hard on that.
Ted, we mentioned earlier your previous book about the closing of the American border, and the issues you brought up in that book arose from a very focusing set of events, which was the 9/11 attacks in particular. The country moved to clamp down on various visitations, not necessarily so much on deportations, but there was an element there of the country clamping down and before things relaxed again. Can you talk a bit about the motivations this time around, though? There's not a 9/11 type of event necessarily, but there is clearly frustration among Trump administration and supporters about the level of illegal immigration, and they see this as necessary. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that's sort of gathered steam?
Yeah, I do think the motivations are a little different. There's obviously something of a security element to this. The travel ban that Jim, you mentioned was a security move. We're worried about people from certain countries who might pose some kind of threat to the United States. But all of what we are seeing in this series of memos is really driven by what I would call both economic and cultural nationalism. So the economic nationalist argument is, look, these people who are coming here, they don't have legal status. They are competition for the American workforce. They are depriving Americans of jobs that Americans should be doing. And this administration really has quite a clear theory that if we reduce the number of these people, then employers are going to be forced to start increasing wages and hiring more Americans for this kind of work, whether it's agriculture, or construction, or landscaping.
Or they can go to automation.
This is the issue, right? We don't actually know that this will produce jobs. But this is very clearly what the administration believes. If you look at Senator Sessions, now Attorney General Jeff Sessions, he's argued this for years. He said, look, these folks, these illegal immigrants are direct competition for American workers, particularly for lower skilled, high school educated American workers. And we're going to help the American worker by getting rid of these people who aren't supposed to be here. And there is, a significant cultural dimension. Look, we are Americans. This is America First administration. We're going to enforce the law. People from other countries who don't have a right to be here, we're going to send them the hell out of here, the way Donald Trump has put it. So the motivations are really, I think, quite different from what you saw under President Bush, which was really more about, we had been attacked. We'd been attacked by people who had found loopholes in our immigration system, and we were going to tighten those to make sure we didn't face that kind of threat again.
Ted, I want to go back to where we opened the podcast, and that was with President Trump's talk about how enforcing immigration on his watch is being carried out as a military operation. The White House almost immediately walked that back and said he was simply using the term military operation to talk about the efficiency with which the enforcement is being carried out, not that it's being carried out by the military. But I suspected a lot of Americans hearing that would say, well, why wouldn't the military be involved in rounding up and deporting people who shouldn't be here? Can you sort of explain to people sort of the military component of this and why the White House so quickly walked it back?
What happened was that there was a rumor that circulated that the National Guard was going to be mobilized to do domestic immigration enforcement. National Guard has been used at times in the past to kind of assist Border Patrol, but more with logistics, with construction, not with actually arresting people, which National Guard has never done before. My understanding, and I hope you two will correct me if I'm wrong, is that under the law we call Posse Comitatus, going back to the 19th century.
1878, Rutherford B. Hayes.
Thank you, Jim. I knew you would know that. So that the U.S. military is not allowed to be used for domestic enforcement operations. So I think there is a rather clear prohibition on using the military for domestic immigration enforcement and removal operations. And General Kelly, the DHS secretary, batted that down really quickly and said, look, we are not talking about using the military. Reality is they don't need to use the military. If they get the sort of staff increase that they're talking about here, they're going to have more than enough, armed individuals to carry out these missions. The military is not going to be.
Yeah, well, I would note that there are very strong institutional incentives and imperatives not to do this. The United States military has no interest that I can detect in this job, and the leaders of the Border Customs Control were very quick to go out and say the military is not needed. This is a specialized job. Thank you very much. We can do it ourselves. So I think there's sort of intra-governmental forces that will keep this from happening.
Yeah, Sean Spicer, the president's spokesman, said, well, he was simply referring to military-type precision in this operation, not to actually using the military. Right. So that's clearly not going to happen, I think.
So, Ted, one of the concerns raised when these memos were announced was that it would result in a huge number of these people in the country illegally going into the shadows and all the problems that could ensue from that. Can you talk a little bit about what we know, how that can happen? Does that mean things like people are not going to the doctor anymore, the children aren't going to school anymore, things like that? Or is that an exaggeration?
No, I don't think that's an exaggeration. We are seeing stories in the papers every day now about families who aren't letting their kids go to school. They're not doing their own grocery shopping. They're trying to get friends to do it for them. They're simply kind of hiding in place in their homes. They're particularly scared to drive because, whenever you drive, there's a chance you don't make the left turn signal when you're supposed to make the left turn signal and you get pulled over by a cop.
Do 30 miles an hour in a 25-mile-an-hour zone.
So we are absolutely seeing that. I think the bigger concern, and you had mentioned the sanctuary city element. I mean, sanctuary cities is a phrase. It's not exactly a precise one, but the big cities in the United States, which is where most of the unauthorized immigrants live, have been reluctant by and large, to cooperate with federal immigration enforcement. Their belief is that local police need to be trusted in these communities. If they're going to investigate crimes, they're going to investigate domestic violence, if they're going to learn about gang activity, they have to have some trust in the community. And if people who are here out of status think the police are an arm of federal immigration authorities, they're not going to cooperate with them. So I think the real fear about people going underground is that local police are not going to be able to operate effectively in these communities anymore because people are going to be too scared to talk to them at all.
But that's something that's very, very hard to measure to know whether that is a real event or something that could just happen theoretically.
I suppose, but you know, the police chiefs in the country have long been pretty united in saying this is a genuine and serious concern for them, and they're talking to their officers about it.
So
I sort of have to trust their professional expertise on this.
I wasn't questioning that. Yeah. I guess I think the thing is in terms of whether you're going to see the kind of pushback that would lead the administration to change its policy, I think it would be very hard to do it based on concerns about it. Interfere with the ability of local cops to find out what's happening in neighborhoods. And again, this gets me sort of the broader question of the consequences of this new immigration enforcement. Clearly, immigration enforcement is being stepped up in the Trump administration, and we've sort of touched on some of the consequences, potentially the ability of local cops to find out who committed a crime in the neighborhood. We also talked a little bit about how it might play out on the economy. And could you sort of walk us through this, Ted? I mean, what are the consequences?
Well, I mean, the honest answer is we don't know precisely because this has not been tried at the scale that I think we're going to see over the next couple of years. I think it will definitely have an impact in workplaces, you know, particularly, as I said, in these sectors where there are a lot of undocumented workers. It's obviously going to have a significant impact on U.S. relations with the countries that are sending a lot of people there, not just Mexico, but particularly the Central American countries. You know, there were been efforts for a long time to try to work cooperatively with these countries to address some of the problems. I think a lot of that's going to be imperiled. I think, you know, U.S.-Mexico relations for a variety of reasons, not just immigration, but trade as well, are in for a very rough patch. I also think we're going to see a lot of conflict between the federal government and state and local governments. So the pipeline historically for a lot of people to be put into the removal system has been local law enforcement. And even under the Obama administration, there were fights between the cities in Washington over whether the cities were going to cooperate. I think those fights are going to get much deeper and rougher. They're going to end up in the courts. I think there are going to be threats from Washington to cut off aid to municipal police forces and other things unless they're going to cooperate. So I think they're going to be some pretty serious battles. I also think that there is the possibility of civil unrest of various sorts. If the Immigration and Customs Enforcement is going more and more aggressively into these communities, you know, arresting mothers with U.S. born children and others, I think you are going to see people rallying in various ways to try to protect these individuals. How that's going to play out, hard to say. But there's the potential here, I think, for a lot of uncomfortable developments.
We've already seen signs of resistance beginning to build up in a variety of cities to try to protect unauthorized or undocumented people from this sort of stepped up deportation. Some people have sent me pictures of posters they see in their neighborhoods, in essence laying out to people what their rights are, what the police can and cannot do. Do you think this is something that is going to sort of move beyond sort of the anecdotal to being a more systematic sort of resistance against deportation?
I do. I think you're going to see the churches play a big role in it. There are a number of churches that have been quite clear that they are willing, in effect, to house and protect people who face deportation. Number of universities. You've had university presidents saying, you know, their students at their schools that they're willing to protect. Now, to be clear, the one group that the Trump administration is not going after are what is known as the DACA recipients. These are the young people who were brought here by their parents. And were given protection under President Obama, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA by
There's
the acronym.
Hundreds of thousands of them.
Yeah. There are about 750,000 who have come forward under the program. And a lot of the university students who without status would be those DACA recipients. And President Trump has so far backed away from going after those individuals. And I'm guessing that if he hasn't done it yet, he's probably not going to do it. But yes, I do think that there will be resistance, and I think it will be institutional. I don't just think it will be sort of ad hoc, neighborhood to neighborhood. But the scale of it, it's hard to know. I mean, at the end of the day, the Trump administration has the law on its side, and it's got the law enforcement officials with the guns on its side. So
Ted, what's next on this front in terms of the wall we referred to, the immigration travel ban, and other steps involving legal immigrants?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're going to see other shoes drop. I think the next question on the wall is really funding. The Trump administration is going to release its budget in the next couple of weeks, and I presume it's going to ask for Congress to fund additional fencing construction. So I think that's kind of the next step on that front. The travel ban, which was halted by the courts, the president has been pretty clear that they're rewriting it. Seems likely it's going to go after those same seven countries that were restricted in the initial travel ban. I'm looking for that in the next week or two. And then I think the biggest shoe that hasn't dropped yet is a systematic effort by the administration and by some of its allies in Congress to try to reduce legal immigration to the United States. You know, I mentioned the economic nationalism that underlies it, that sees immigrants as competition for American workers. That's true not just at the lower skilled end, but at the higher skilled end as well. The H-1B program that brings a lot of Indians and Chinese over to work in the United States. The administration has said it would like to rein that program in different ways. Work opportunities for foreign students after they graduate from American universities suggested it wants to curb those. And you have members of Congress who have introduced legislation that would cut legal immigration in the United States roughly in half, from the roughly 1 million legal immigrants we admit every year to about 500,000. The Republican Party has become, and you can see this in Congress, really much more of an immigration restrictionist party than it's ever been in the past. I don't know whether that gets through. There'll be strong resistance, obviously, in the Senate. But it's hard to overestimate how much of a change this is from Ronald Reagan's Republican Party. This is a radically different Republican Party on the issue of immigration. And I think we're going to be seeing the consequences of that for some time to come.
Well, on that note, we will end this episode of The President's Inbox. Ted, thanks for joining us again today.
Good to be with you. Thanks.
Please subscribe to The President's Inbox on iTunes and leave us a review. It really helps. Please note that opinions expressed in The President's Inbox are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions. Today's episode was produced by Kevin Lizarazzo with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock, recording engineer Dan Mudd, and with special thanks to Audrey Bowler. This is Jim Lindsay.
And this is Bob McMahon. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on The President's Inbox.